cut your yard. All please rise. Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you. Y'all can be seated. Thank you so much. The Third Court of Appeals welcomes you to the court. Justice Theofanis and Crump and I are pleased to have you here. Counsels, please introduce yourself to the court.
Your Honor, Travis J. Phillips here for the appellant this morning.
Thank you.
Ian Pittman with Courtney Crossley here on behalf of the FLE, April Vanderbilt, formerly April Travis, and we are ready.
Thank you. This is cause number 0325528CV in the interest of Travis versus Travis Vanderbilt. Counsels, as you know, this matter is being broadcast on our YouTube channel today. Also, counsels, as you know, we have our time system here. Green means you've got 20 minutes, or for the opening, appellant 15, and then yellow means you have 2 minutes left, and then red means you need to wrap up. I understand we'll go 15, 20, and then 5 for rebuttal. So with that, we'll go ahead and tender the floor to the appellant. Thank you, Mr. Phillips. You may proceed.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the gravamen of the dispute here today is an agreed protective order.
And yes, if you'll speak yes. up, counsel, thank you.
The gravamen of today's dispute is an agreed protective order. Factually, appellant and appellee were previously married. While the divorce was pending in a separate cause and case, an application of protective order was filed by appellee. This application had numerous allegations that were made under the affidavit that was attached to it. It did not come to a contested hearing.
I'm still having difficulty hearing you.
Absolutely,
you
Your Honor.
Speaking up. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll get closer to the microphone.
You can move it if it's easier.
The protective order did not come to a contested hearing. Instead, the parties reached a mediated settlement agreement in the divorce case, pursuant to which an agreement was reached regarding the protective order. An agreed protective order was entered. The agreed protective order, as entered, recites that it is created under either Article 7B of the Code of Criminal Procedures or Chapter 85 of the Texas Family Code. That in and of itself is not problematic. The key issue that we brought forward on appeal is that at the very end, the durational provision of the protective order recites that it is pursuant to Article 7B before creating an indefinite duration. Now, there is no question, Your Honors, that the indefinite nature of the protective order was part of the agreed terms negotiated in the mediated settlement agreement. The question that was raised at the trial court level on the motion for reconsideration, relevant to the appeal, was that Article 7B does not appear to be correctly applied in the order, which is to say the text of Article 7B requires that there be specific fact findings to substantiate it. There are no fact findings in the order. There have never been any evidentiary findings made in the case except that the parties were in agreement and a recitation that the order is made without any findings of family violence. And so appellant's position on that and the reason for the appeal is that that is reversible error. That indefinite duration should not have been allowed into the order under Article 7B, because 7B does not allow for the, legally, the statute's plain language does not allow for the waiver of the necessary findings. And that indicates either that the court should have made findings, in which case that needs to be addressed, or that the parties made a mistake of law and that's an error that needs to be resolved. And that however the protective order duration is ultimately established, it needs to be clear that it's not under 7B.
And counsel, why did you not address the issue of waiver at all in your briefing?
Your Honor, we attempted to address that partially through our, imprecisely, through our discussion about how agreement does not obviate the need for statutory compliance. And one of the cases we cite, Your Honor, I think is the most directly on point on this matter, and that is the case of INRI IEW, which is a 2010 case out of the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals. In re IEW is quite analogous to this case. That was an agreed protective order that was entered. It had a two-year duration.
Is it a published case?
Or yes,
is
sir.
It a memo?
Your Honor, give me one moment. Your Honor, that's a memo.
I thought it was a memo. Okay.
Yeah. Factually, however, it's the closest to this case because that was an agreed protective order, a two-year duration. The trial court made findings of fact and conclusions of law that because of the agreement to the protective order, the party was stopped from seeking a motion to vacate approximately 1 year after the order was entered. Now, the Court of Appeals reversed and ultimately vacated the protective order because it was just argued that it had not made necessary findings. Now, that case is somewhat distinguishable because of the different statutory situation in 2010 versus today. That was dealing with Chapter 85 before you had a carve-out exception for agreed protective orders under 85.005. But the underlying reasoning is still applicable. And the reason that case is so on point is that Article 7B doesn't have a carve-out.
Is there any such case under the Third Court of Appeals line of authority?
Your Honor, we have not identified any case that's directly on point.
Okay.
This is the most analogous case of any that we found.
Okay, thank you.
And the relief that you're seeking today is a vacation of the lifetime provision and I guess a modification to a two-year provision. Is that what you're asking for, or just complete vacation?
Your Honor, it is a voidable provision, is our position. And so if the provision itself is just voided out, it would be 2 years duration by default. If the court were to remand, on the other hand, for further consideration, because plain language of the MSA, the parties did intend an indefinite protective order, then the consideration would be what the party's intent would have been and what the agreement should have been.
But we know the party's intent because they signed off on an
MSA. But did the intent include that they would have an Article 7B requirement? Because Article 7B says you have to have these specific findings. And there is case law to the effect that we have cited that while you can agree to a protective order, you're not necessarily willing to agree to implicit findings.
The parties did use, though, the form that was approved by the OCA and the Supreme
Court.
That
is correct, Your Honor. What is noticeable about that form is it looks like some of the language options at the last provision, the durational provision, were taken out so that it just references Article 7B rather than referencing, for example, Chapter 85.
To Chapter 85. Is that portion is missing from the form?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that is one of the interesting conflicts that the order presents, because even though it initially recites that it's under either 7B or Chapter 85, the durational provision itself recites only that it's under Article 7B.
Counsel, is it your position that an MSA cannot waive statutory requirements?
Your Honor, the answer to that comes on two levels. Generally speaking, an agreed order can see statutory requirements waived. But an agreed protective order is a somewhat different scenario than a generic agreed order. And we know that looking at the statutory structure, because looking at, for example, 87.001, the Texas Family Code, we see that a protective order is inherently subject to modification, even as a final order. Either party can theoretically come and request it and seek to modify existing terms, to add terms, or to remove terms. We know as well that the statutes provide for the right to seek a motion to vacate at some point in the future, subject to procedures and limitations within the statutes. So in this specific context, there is a recognized right to seek to change the protective order, regardless of waiver. And Your Honor, I think that's also emphasized by Chapter 85 reciting at 85.001 that a protective order is not a contract. Unlike a traditional consent judgment or an agreed judgment where you're looking specifically in contract terms, a protective order is subject to court review. It's not just that the parties have agreed to it, it's that the court has reviewed it and made the decision on its authority that the protective order has merit and should stand on that merit.
And the only authority you're relying on is IEW.
Your Honor, IEW is the case most closely on point. There are four different cases we cite in our brief to the effect that failure to correctly apply the law the specific fact findings that need to be included.
But do any of those cases involve an agreement?
No, Your Honor. Okay. No. This is the most analogous case.
Our sister court, Hampton, our El Paso Court of Appeals in Hampton v. Helton, just in 2024, there was an agreed protective order, same case. How, if at all, can you distinguish that case?
Your Honor, would you permit me to grab my computer?
Certainly, certainly. It's
I apologize. I have the case up on the computer and just a very slow computer.
Sure. I'm not trying to trick you or anything.
No, no.
I'm trying to understand if there's some distinction that you found between the cases.
Your Honor, that case specifically, I think worth noting, is that was dealing with whether or not there was a stalking protective order. And it drew a distinction between the actual type of protective order at play. This is a case where we can't draw that distinction because there were no findings issued. In their application, the appellee did make stalking allegations, but because there were never contested hearing, never any evidentiary findings made, the most we can say is that the court found the order was in the best interest of the parties and there were no family violence findings.
Okay, so you're saying just there were enough facts in the record to support findings, even though the judge didn't expressly make the findings in the order?
Yes, there is no record that would substantiate those sorts of findings like we see in some of these other cases, Your Honor.
But doesn't that, your argument kind of puts people in an unusual situation and undercuts parties in the future reaching agreements on protective orders, correct? It makes people not want to reach agreements so that they can avoid going through the nasty evidentiary record and just cut to the chase of entering a protective order, such as your client did, so that they don't have to get a record of all the bad acts that occurred. And they just cut to the chase agreeing to a protective order versus now we're going to have a record sworn of all the bad acts we did to get to an evidentiary finding of the bad things that we did and get that into a protective order. So it's your client's position. I would rather have had an order that found that I did all these bad things and I wouldn't be here on appeal attacking the protective order that I agreed to because they found that I stalked her. They found that I did all these things to her car and that I did these horrible things to her shampoo and that I did these things. I would have rather have done that than reach an agreement.
Your Honor, I think in this particular case, it's not so much that let me rephrase this. It's not so much that the position of appellant is that you should be discouraging the entry of agreed protective orders, because there's a value to having agreed protective orders. The issue is that in this particular instance, the agreed protective order that was created is based on having a duration that imposes requirements that are extraneous to the rest of the case, which is to say you don't have findings to substantiate a 7B duration. If the order was clearly formatted and made only under Chapter 85, the procedural stance would be very different. And 85, of course, admits that if an order is made of whatever duration as an agreed order under 85, you don't have to have the Chapter 85 findings. And that is a relatively new feature compared to some of this.
But what I'm looking at the protective order now, and it expressly states that the court finds that the agreement does not require the applicant to do or refrain from doing acts under Section 85.022. So it is referenced there.
It absolutely is, Your Honor. The sole discrepancy is that the durational provision at the very end is based on 7B rather than a reference to 85.
But didn't your client agree to waive all post-order rights?
Your Honor, the text of the agreement does say there is appellate waiver of appeal. At the point that I would make on that is, again, referencing the IEW. Even where there has been agreement, that doesn't necessarily waive the obligation of legal compliance.
And what is that based on? What do you base that argument on?
Certainly, Your Honor. In IEW, that was an agreed protective order of 2 years' duration. Approximately 1 year after it was entered, the appellant in that case sought a motion to vacate. The court, in its findings and conclusions of law, noted, and part of the basis for its denial of the motion was finding that the appellant was stopped from seeking to vacate the protective order because of his prior agreement. Now, that is very much analogous to a waiver of rights by agreement in an agreed protective order like we have here.
Okay. So again, a memo op from Corpus Christi is what you're standing on?
Your Honor, it is, I think, without question, the most analogous case.
And that's 2010?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. And Your Honor, the noticeable thing about the reasoning in that case is that while Chapter 85 has been modified to allow for waiver of findings in an agreed protective order, Article 7B hasn't. And so the fact that we have that reference to Article 7B means we're not dealing with just the, what I would say, the normal statutory setup that you would expect under 85.
Thank you, counsel. We'll come back to you in a few minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Pittman.
Good morning, Chief Justice Byrne, Justices Crump and Theofanis, and may it please the court. My name is Ian Pittman. As I said earlier, I represent the appellee, April Vanderbilt. We believe that this appeal should be dismissed due to a lack of jurisdiction based off of the clear and express waiver on the face of the agreed protective order. Alternatively, if the court does decide to reach the merits, the trial court's judgment should be affirmed. And let's be clear about why we believe this should happen. First and foremost, as we said, the appellant waived his right to bring any post-order relief, including the right to appeal. In addition, even if he had not checked that box, he agreed to the protective order. And this court has consistent precedent that a party cannot appeal from an order to which he agreed. Additionally, there is, I think, an imprecise distinction being drawn in the appellant's brief between a voidable order and conflagration or with a void order. I think the distinction that's important is that at most this would be a voidable order that is not subject to collateral attack, which is what this appeal actually is, because as I said at the outset, he has waived his right to a direct appeal. Therefore, any post-judgment motion would be a collateral attack. And I think most real-world consequence would be an absurd result that if the court gave credence to the argument of the appellant, it would incentivize respondents and protective orders to agree to a duration that is longer than 2 years up to their lifetime. And then, as very shortly after the ink is dry on the court's signature, file an appeal to say that violates the statute, even though I agreed to it, even though I avoided the findings by agreeing to it. I think that result is not one that this court should condone, and it's not one that the protective order system is meant to invite.
Mr. Pittman, what significance do you find in the appellant's argument that the durational paragraph or component of the order does not refer specifically to the family code, but the order itself has some reference to the family code, and that the durational component of the order only refers to the criminal code. In any comment with regard to that at all?
Yes, Your Honor. I do have comment on that. Specifically, I think it misses the mark by focusing on one subsection of Article 7B and not looking at the entirety of Article 7B. The entirety of Article 7B allows and incorporates Title IV of the Family Code, which specifically authorizes agreed protective orders. And so therefore, Article 7B in and of itself does encompass and consider courts doing exactly what they did in this case. In fact, one of the cases cited by the appellant in his brief, it's out of El Paso, the SM case, held specifically that while Article 7B does not specifically authorize agreed protective orders, it does not explicitly prohibit agreed protective orders.
And so you're looking at page 16 and 17 of your brief?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
But because I don't think we even have to get there, because I think the waiver argument is so strong in this case. And the facts are abundantly clear. Mr. Travis agreed not once but twice to waive his right to appeal, to waive any post-judgment motions, including the motion to reconsider that was filed at the trial court level. That's at clerk's record 82 on the MSA, the attachment to the MSA, with the box checked, waiving his rights to appeal, and clerk's record 88, which is the actual agreed protective order with that same box checked. On clerk's record 76, the appellant signed the MSA inches below a statement which is unique, and I'm going to read it verbatim because it's so important, where he agreed that each party's attorney read and explained to that party the entire contents of this agreement, as well as the legal consequences of this agreement. That's on page 76 of the clerk's record. Also on page 76 is Mr. Travis's signature on the mediated settlement agreement. On page 23 of the clerk's record, we have the agreed protective order, which contains his signature right above the, that is where the box is also checked in the clerk's record. On page 27 of the clerk's record, that is where the appellant signed and consented to the agreed protective order, both as to form and to substance. So not just once, but twice, he absolutely and unequivocally waived his right to any post-judgment motion, including the right to appeal. As the Supreme Court has said for decades, waiver is the intentional relinquishment of a known right or intentional conduct inconsistent with claiming that right. He did both of these things. He intentionally relinquished his right, not once, but twice, and he took conduct by not trying to have a motion to enter or any other thing that he could have done at trial court level to correct this inconsistency between the MSA and the agreed protective order that he now complains on appeal. And to the court's point, this is something that has not been addressed. It was not addressed at the trial court level. The trial court brought it up during the hearing on the motion to reconsider. It was not brought up in the appellant's brief. The appellant did not file a response to the appellee's brief. So he has not addressed this issue at all. So I think that is the strongest argument. I think that's the cleanest vehicle for this court to address the question here, is to just dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. He waived his right to appeal. But if we get past that, if for whatever reason we get past that, we then go to the agreed judgment rule. This court last year in the Kennedy versus Kennedy case expressly said a party cannot appeal from a judgment to which he has consented absent fraud, collusion, or misrepresentation. There are no allegations at the trial court level. There's no evidence in the clerk's record or in the reporter's record of any of those three things. And that's not a new rule. That wasn't something this court announced last year. That was something that the court reaffirmed from 2021 in the Carter v. Berman case. And that is something that in both of those cases, the court referred to the Gillum Republic Health Corporation case out of the Dallas Court of Appeals from 1989. And that court held that the rationale of such a rule is that a party will not be allowed to complain on appeal of an action or a ruling which he invited or induced. It's exactly what Mr. Travis did. He invited the error of which he is now complaining. He agreed not once but twice to enter an agreed protective order with a lifetime duration to avoid the exact findings that Chief Justice pointed out.
And what significance do you lay at the feet of the IEW case?
Your Honor, I think IEW is easily distinguishable for a couple of reasons. First, as the court pointed out, it's a 26-year-old precedent. The forms that are required are a 3-year-old form. So these forms did not exist in 2010 when that order came down. Additionally, that was an appeal of a motion to vacate under the family code. That is what the appellant should have done in this case. He should not have brought a direct appeal. He waived his right to bring that direct appeal. What he should have done is looked at the family code or looked at Article 7B. Both of them have statutory mechanisms. It's in 85.025 of the family code. It's in 7B.009 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. There are specific statutory mechanisms where an either respondent or applicant, if certain conditions are met, can file a motion to vacate, to amend, or to rescind a protective order and either add or remove anything that could have been added or removed in the original protective order. So the IEW case, that's what that appellant did. He didn't file a direct appeal based off of his agreed protective order, even though it didn't have the form that would have waived that right. He still would have had to have gotten past the agreed judgment rule, so he knew he couldn't do that. What did he do? He looked at the family code. He looked at what the procedure was. He followed that procedure, and when the trial court, after that order was made, and after those findings of fact were made, appealed from that. He didn't short-circuit the process and take steps that are expressly waived by the terms of that order. So I think that it's extremely distinguishable from this case here, because in this case, our appellant refuted his right to make an appeal. And instead of doing what was statutorily required, statutorily authorized, he did something that was expressly waived.
I have a question about just the remedy. So I understand the appellant arguing just that we should find that there should be a default to the 2-year protective order. But he also discussed a potential remand for the trial court to collect these required findings. And so procedurally, do you think that that is an avenue that this court can or should take to send it back to the trial court to have the court actually create those findings, include them in the order after some sort of a prove up or something of that nature?
I don't believe this court can or should for two reasons, Justice Crump. The first reason is it would violate and frustrate the agreements of the MSA, and the Supreme Court's ruling in Henry Lee says that the trial court has very little discretion to go past an MSA. And what is required for an agreed protective order is that the court find that the parties agreed to it and the court find that the agreements are in the applicant's best interest. The court did that in this case, so there's no legal error of what the court did. What I think the court can do in either dismissing the appeal or affirming the trial court's judgment is leave open, well, the court doesn't have to do this, but can expressly say that the avenue which is open to the appellant is under Chapter 85.025 or Chapter 7B.009. Go through, do those things. If at that point the trial court needs to have a hearing and put findings in that could have been put into the agreed protective order, that is what should happen, because one, they exist. I mean, they're clear from the clerk's record and the unrefuted allegations in the affidavit, the unrefuted allegations in the response to the motion to reconsider have not been refuted in any way. Those can be proved up at that point in time, but I believe the correct procedural mechanism is the dismissal, or at a minimum, affirming trial court's order, but that does not preclude this appellant or any appellant who is similarly situated from going and filing a motion to vacate, a motion to amend, a motion to rescind under the procedure that's already laid out in the protective order system.
The Article 85B language, it was removed from the form. Is that what the parties agreed to? Because that's what I understood the appellant to be arguing.
I don't quite understand the appellant's argument. It wasn't briefed, so I'm hearing that for the first time today. My understanding is that even if that were true, because he approved what was signed by the court as the form and substance, it is not uncommon and it is not reversible error. It's not an abuse of discretion, certainly, for parties to agree to something slightly different in the judgment that is presented to the court than what was in the MSA, as long as they agreed to it. Now, if he had raised that issue on a motion to enter and said this proposed agreed order doesn't match the MSA, then the court could have taken the time to say this is the form that was attached to the MSA. It's different than the form that is being presented to me. I'm going to interlineate or modify before I sign this to conform to the agreements of the MSA, but he waived that ability to do that when he did that, when he agreed to that.
There was a motion for reconsideration on the last day of plenary power of the trial court.
Correct.
Was that addressed at all? And I haven't read that portion of the record at
this
point.
It was addressed to my recollection. There was multiple points of error, so to speak, in the motion to reconsider that were raised. I do believe that the incongruence between the attachment to the MSA and the agreed protective order that was signed by the court, I believe, was raised. But I believe in both reviewing the reporter's record and my recollection of that hearing was that the trial court was more interested in the waiver language and pointed it out more than once and told the appellant that I don't know how you get past this. And so I think even though that was raised, the trial court says you waive your right to even be bringing this motion, so I can't get there. Not in his written order. The written order just simply denies the motion to reconsider, but in the reporter's record.
One question for you, a factual question. When did the trial court sign the divorce decree?
That is a good question. I might need Ms. Crossley to find that and have that answered. I don't know if it was on the same day as the protective order or if it was at a different date of the protective order, but they are in different cause numbers. So the trial court issued two separate orders and two separate causes.
Just as a follow-up question to that, were they negotiated at the same mediation?
Yes, Justice Crump, they were. So the sort of order of events, the timeline was that my client, Ms. Vanderbilt, filed a divorce petition, asked for a temporary restraining order, didn't ask for a protective order at first, for some pretty egregious behaviors, was granted an ex parte temporary restraining order. That didn't stop the behaviors, and in fact, they intensified. And because they intensified, going so far as to break into her home after they were living apart, adulter her belongings, cut her phone line, she sought and received an ex parte temporary protective order. And the duration of that ex parte order overlapped with a previously scheduled mediation. And so the parties were able to attend mediation and negotiate both the resolution of the divorce and the protective order.
So this was a holistic agreement that included presumably, everything included in that mediated settlement agreement was part and parcel of a whole mediation. And so agreements that were reached were presumably agreements that related to the protective order.
Correct, Your Honor. So there are three attachments, A, B, and C, to the MSA. A and B deal with the division of property and some sort of housekeeping matters. C is an actual agreed protective order. That is their statements to the MSA that the parties will have this protective order signed by the court at a later date. And I think it was signed within 2 weeks after that mediation, it was signed.
And Mr. Pittman, I note that you're running out of time. At the end, you're asking for sanctions. If I read your briefing correctly, your client is requesting $6,015.73 in sanctions. Is that accurate?
That is accurate, Your Honor. We are asking for sanctions under Rule 45. The reason being that there's just such a clear waiver of appeal in this case, and there's been no argument addressing that waiver. And it has placed an undue burden both on my client, but also on this court. As this court has said in the Starcrest Trust v. Berry case from 1996, those are the types of situations when sanctions are appropriate. I believe they quoted the Dolenz v. AB case from Dallas out of 1987, which said that spurious litigation unnecessarily burdening parties and courts should not go unsanctioned. Very rarely do I agree that a statement from a previous case applies almost one for one to a current case, but I think this is spurious litigation that unnecessarily burdens the parties in the court. And that is the ask. We are asking for those amount of fees. We did not prove up additional fees, but it is roughly equivalent. It's less than actually what my client has incurred for the appeal. We're not charging her for the oral arguments here today, but for the briefing and everything else, that is the request we're asking for sanction. And if there's nothing else, I see that I'm out of time, so I thank the court.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, counsel, Mr. Phillips.
May it please the court. Your Honors, the point I will try to reemphasize from previously is that the underlying substantive issue is that statutory compliance is a reversible error. That itself, just as a general principle, is not really in question. Multiple cases have found that, generally speaking, if you have an obligation to make findings and those findings aren't included, that is a reversible error under an abuse of discretion standard. The issue in this case really ties back to whether or not that can be brought forward. And I think the key consideration, I keep talking back about INRI IEW, of course, the underlying substantive analysis on that, looking at the parties and the issues brought, whether you're looking at that under a motion to vacate pursuant to statute, which appellees have acknowledged is available, whether you're looking at under a direct appeal, you're still looking at the same substantive underlying issue, which is that the statutory requisites of 7B weren't met in the order. And that is a problem that was pointed out to the trial court and that should be resolved. The law is clear under Chapter 85 that a protective order is not a contract. It's got an extra layer on top of it instead of just purely an agreement, which is the court's review. And if the court is going to enact an order and that order is going to stand on the court's authority, it should be accurate to the law. And so the durational provision needs to be restructured to address that and to fix the error.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thanks to both of you for the briefing and the good argument. This case will be submitted and the court will stand in recess. Thank you both.